things that I've wanted to kind of talk about is decision making. And we've already spoken about a few kind of decisions that have been made in the Premier League, especially in the game at the weekend, where the mighty Arsenal
have won a game.
Glad
you're not wearing my Tottenham shirt. You'd be stretching it by now. You're pulling your chest out. It's like ripping his shirt off like the Incredible Hulk.
Yes.
You're lucky this is an audio podcast.
I'm just enjoying the basking in the
we'll see you in the Europa League. We'll see you in the UEFA League final. There you go. We'll be on a plane for that.
You've got to get there first. I think this I think your season could collapse now.
No, we'll fight back.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk decision making and what we as coaches can help to do to improve decision making, because you know the game itself is heavily dependent on good decisions. You know, the best players are able to make good decisions at split second time, and so how are they able to do that? What are the key kind of characteristics of their game that helps them be able to make those kinds of decisions? If how do they correct themselves if the decision making has been poor? I feel like there's a few steps when you look at the decision making process. There's a few steps that you have to kind of take into consideration, and most of them are kind of information based. You know, when you're on the field, you want to get as much information as possible, and this is why we work with players about scanning shoulders, checking shoulders every few seconds. Checking shoulders, know what's going on around you. And again, you're doing this in relation to the four kind of reference points of the game. So you're looking at, you want to know where the ball is, you want to know where your teammates are, where your opponents are positioned, and then where the space is. And I've always coached the game from a perspective of space. Where is the space? You're trying to exploit opponent space because your opponent is trying to restrict space. And this is where the transitions come in so important, because when you've got the ball, you want to expand the space and make the space as much as possible. So you've got areas to play into. But when you make the space big, it's then difficult for your opponent to cover. They have to spread out to cover the space. And so those four reference points, I think the process goes kind of something like this. The first thing that you want to do is identify what the problem is. As the ball's on its way into you, you scanned your shoulder, you've taken in those four reference points. Now, what's the issue? Are you being pressed? That kind of thing. And so once you've done that, you then want to kind of have an analysis of that issue. So you've identified there's an issue. What's the analysis of it? Do I have time to open up my body, receive back foot and play quickly? Do I have to come back across my body because there's a defender there? Do I have the time to open up? That sort of stuff.
That's like three or four questions in a split second. In a split second in a game, it goes. It's
and,
so
and,
quickly.
And usually these things are happening before you've even got the ball.
Yeah, yeah. Is why it's so important. Is the scan. I call it take pictures. Every time you don't have the ball, take a picture of the field, check your shoulder, take a picture. Because when you do get the ball, you're in a really good position to know what to do with it. Maybe first time, touch and move. I mean, I was out last night working with my young ladies, and I'm like, girls, now what? Don't just pass and stand there and admire what you've done. Ask yourself, now what can I do now? What's my next phase? That's part of the decision making, is what do I do after that? How quickly can I react to my own work? Let's put the ball out wide. Then what do? You push up, you sit back in the pocket. These decision making, sometimes some of them are made without the ball. So when you do get the ball, you make the best decision for your team in that space, in that transitional moment. Right now, do I need one touch and play it wide for safety? Do I take two touches and dribble? There's a space. Do I penetrate that space? And there's certain things that come into it, like the environment of the game. Are we winning? Are we losing? Where's the ball? You know, there's so many certain things that tactically, technically, you know, environmentally, there's a lot of things to think about. But, you know, the main point, Anna, every age group I play with or I work with, make sure you take pictures of the field whenever you can. I think there's a really good lesson there. I think one of the best examples is Frank Lampard, probably one of the best centre mids, attacking mid, goals. There's a great video of him on YouTube somewhere. We'll find it and put it on social media. He doesn't have the ball for about 10 seconds, but in that 10 seconds, he's checking his shoulder every split second. If I get the ball right now. And he's moving. He's not just standing there. He's not static. He's like, edge of the box. If I get the ball right now, shoot. If I get the ball right now, pass. And he's just moving around, checking his shoulder every split second. And I think, especially like for everyone in general, but for a good, if you want to be a good attacking mid, you know, the ability to like make that right decision, really critical decision thinking in a really short space of time is something that, you know, you need to work on a lot. I think some of this comes from watching games, watching like the past masters, watching Pirlo, you know, Kaká, you know, these Brazilian guys and the Italian guys, some of these centre mids have dominated world soccer. Watching them play, just watching what they do when they don't have the ball, as important as what they do when they've got the ball, for me.
Yeah, there's this thing that we say in the game where it's like the best players can slow time down around them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, you see a player receive the ball. I mentioned in the last podcast that I thought Partey kind of was like a bit of a Rolls Royce. Didn't seem to move very quickly, but was always able to receive the ball with time, you know? And that's where that scanning comes in as well. You know, I don't necessarily think it's just for, you know, midfielders, although it's extremely important because that's kind of the most condensed kind of area of the field. But every player should be, like you say, taking a picture. But then the movement, you mentioned Frank Lampard's constantly moving while he's checking. And basically what he's doing is moving into those spaces. He's picking up positions either behind the line or dropping off into a space where he can get it. And that's why it looks like when he receives the ball, he's got a ton of time. But make no mistake about it, the movement was purposeful. When he receives the ball, he might look like he's got a ton of time, but he already knows what he wants to do, you know? And so I think, as I've mentioned, you identify the problem, you analyze the problem. But then one of the things that I think gets missed is the tactical understanding of the game. You know, what is it that you were trying to achieve? What's the game plan? You know, if we know, if we're playing against a team that get that like to get very narrow, then you know we want to identify, you know, is the team narrow on one side of the field? So now you're already looking at what's the problem. The problem is we can't attack down this side of the field. Analyze the problem now. How can I solve this problem? So now it's like, well, the tactical part of the game is going to be, the tactical understanding of the game is going to be, can I work the ball to the other side quickly to try and force the other team to shift so that we can attack space or to create separation between those defenders as they shift. And so having a tactical understanding of what you're trying to achieve fits into everything, because now I'm checking my shoulder. I'm checking my shoulder purposely because I want to know, where is that fullback? I want to know, where's my teammate? I want to see, is there space over there? As I'm doing that, I'm moving into an area where I can receive the ball and receive it on my back foot. So I can now drive the ball out there. We can capitalize on that space and that situation. I then think knowing your options is another thing that you need to, again, take into consideration before you get the ball or just as you're receiving the ball, you know, because in this scenario that we're talking about, my initial thought will be to try to get the ball out to my wide player who's in space. But as that ball's on its way into me, if the pass is maybe slightly delayed or if it's not a heavier pass and that's given the opponent time to shift, now I need to recalculate my options. My tactical plan was to go out there, but the now is there space? Yeah. Is there space between their fullback and the center back where I could play a 10? Or is my striker looking to go behind? Can I play into in between defenders for a striker? So, you know, knowing what your options are is another thing. And you're going to have, if the movement around you is good enough, you're going to have multiple options. So then it's in that decision-making process, the next thing is, these are my options, which is the best option? And so trying to, you know, identify what the best option is, you know, again, risk reward. And I've spoken about this before, especially on social, on my social media, when people have, going back to the Arsenal again, when people have, criticized Xhaka for playing sideways a lot. You know, he's a defensive midfielder. He's a holding midfielder. If he gives the ball away, knowing that the Arsenal are in a, or that his team are in an attacking shape, they're spread out, they're trying to make the field as big as possible, he puts them under a lot of pressure to transition quickly. And so is the risk of playing that through pass, is it worth taking where maybe he's not quite sure that he's going to be able to get it through, and then there's no reward for it? You know, in, if anything, it's a punishment, because now we're having to try to track back. We're having to try to slow down the attack. We're having to try to get players, you know, back. And so that risk reward kind of thing comes into, you know, your decision making. If it's a, an Odegaard on the edge of the box, he's much more likely to be able to take the risk, knowing that he's got players behind him. You know? And so,
and also there's the individual traits of that player. I mean, you know, for Tottenham, like Højbjerg is a phenomenal player. Works really, really hard. Doesn't get a lot of glory. Scores one goal every year.
And but, you he know, gets he, run he around by Arsenal players.
last time. Move on, Angela. Move on. But he's not one of those risk players. He wants reward, because he knows if he gives the ball away, you know, he's got to put in an extra work, extra shift. So I think, you know, some players keep it simple, as I call it, the KISS syndrome. Keep it simple, stupid, as my coaches used to call me. But then maybe I was just stupid. I don't know. Probably.
Well,
but, you know, just keep it simple.
Supporting Spurs, yeah, definitely.
Well, yeah. If there's a simple, easy pass on that keeps your team in possession, sure, go for it, if that's your ability level. But if you're a really gifted player, like sometimes you'll see some of the world's greatest players pick out a pass from 50 yards from the eye of a needle.
Pepe's pass into Lacazette's feet for a penalty, maybe?
Yeah. There was one yesterday where the commentator said it should be the other way around. It should be Bale crossing and Kane headering, but it was Kane crossing. Just like you say, risk reward. Some players don't like the risk, so they keep it simple. There's so many great midfielders out there that just never give the ball away because they don't try anything amazing. There are other players in that team that can do the amazing things. Like Højbjerg will run 50 yards, Kante will do it, to slide tackle someone, then pass 5 yards. That's their job. But then there's one player who will run 50 yards, get the ball, dribble past three players, put the ball into space from 25 yards. So, you know, that risk-reward comes down to a little bit of personal traits. How technically gifted are you? And if you've got the, because, you know, I think it was Pirlo said that, or Kaká, that soccer is 99% in the brain. And I actually had this conversation with a young lady I'm working with this week, high school age, that, you know, she gets it into her head before every high school game that she doesn't deserve to start. And then she goes out there and the first 10 minutes are awful. And, you know, just go out there and get rid of all the negative thoughts, make your decision-making really clean and simple. Oh, there's a 10-yard pass that I can make. Do it. There's a 15-yard pass. I think I can do it. Go for it. You know, and I've worked with Angelo for many years now. And one of the funniest things I think I ever saw, and I thought it was funny at the time, was where we were playing a high-profile game and Angelo pulled off one of our best centre mids. And we were, at the time, we were working ODP, Fawns, so some of the more quality players in the area. And you pulled off one of our players in the middle of a game as centre mid. I think it was Maya Gutman. And you kept her on the sideline for like 3 or 4 minutes. And we actually conceded a goal in that moment. And she's looking over her shoulder. But Angela, they've got the ball. Looking up, she was scanning, which she probably shouldn't have been. but we were developing her brain. We were telling her, hey, right now, we need you to be doing this better. Okay, we conceded a goal while you're off the field for 2 or 3 minutes. But one of the letters in ODP is development, and we were developing a decision making by pulling her out for not even a minute, maybe 30 seconds.
Having a conversation.
And at the time, I thought you was crazy, but now I've done that 1,000 times. I'm like, just sit out and watch for a minute.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Sit out and watch.
Yeah. And you know, all I do is, you know, I'm just asking questions. Just, you know, I want to know where your thought process is. You know, what's this? What's the issue that you're having at the moment? You know, how do you think you can solve it? Okay, have you maybe considered this as a second solution? Can you think of a third? Now that I've given you an idea for a second, can you think of a third solution? Yeah.
Rather than us as coaches joysticking, as they call it, telling the players what to do, they don't learn. And then when they get to a certain level, they're like, well, my coach didn't tell me what to do. Yeah. It's like, no, you have to be logical, and you know, you have to think of certain things for yourself out there, because
absolutely,
we're behind that line and we're shouting and ranting and raving, do this, do that. You can't hear us because you're focused on what you're doing at that specific moment, that one nanosecond of time you have to pull the trigger, make that pass, make that tackle, make that run. So the more information we give our players in training sessions, the more they can take onto the field, the better decision making they can make.
Yeah, I think something I learned actually from a group of coaches I worked with when I first came to America was, don't coach the player with the ball, coach the players around the ball. You know, so my center mid's got a ball. Is the forward showing? You know, is the wide player showing, or are they attacking the space? So I will ask the wide player, where's the space? I'll ask the center forward, for example, can you show, or who's showing? You know, that kind of thing. So the player on the ball gets to make the decision themselves. I'm just trying to stimulate the movement and the players around them into thinking about what they can do, you know, going back to the whole kind of cycle of decision making, the last kind of, once you've selected what your best option is, you know, you've weighed up that risk reward, you've made your decision, then you've got to execute. And once you've executed, then you analyze. So going through that whole process again. So we're looking at, you identify a problem, then you need to do an analysis of the problem. Once you've analyzed it, where does your tactical plan come into consideration? Then you need to know what your options are. And this is all based around those reference points of teammates, opponents, ball, space. Once you've kind of had a look at all of the potential options, choose which is the best option for me. And you use your risk reward to help you decide what's your best option. Once you've chosen your option, execute and analyze, and then and then the cycle starts again. Now you're looking at what's the next problem, analyze that problem, how does the tactical plan fit into it, etc., etc., etc. You know, now how as coaches can we develop that? And I think you touched on it earlier, the training environment, because what we don't want to do is, like you say, we don't want to joystick players on the sideline. We want to give the players the freedom to be able to make the mistakes, make their own decisions in their game, and learn from it. That's part of that evaluation of, you know, your analysis of your execution, your decision that you've made. And one thing I like to use a lot, multi-directional games. You know, we've seen it enough in the youth game where teams are forward, 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 forward all the time, forward, forward, forward. And you know, that may work for some people, but what are you learning about the game? You know,
very little.
Can I put you in a situation where, for example, when you're in attack, you've got four directions that you can attack. So in order to decide which is the best, you have to take in a lot more information. You're having to know what's going on around you 360, maybe 270 degrees, to be able to make the decision that's best for your team.
Yeah.
So having targets where, you know, they're kind of spread around the field, as opposed to just one direction,
are
helpful in specifically building that kind of decision making.
But it starts at the training ground. You know,
absolutely.
You turn around to your team, say, look, tonight we're going to work on decision making. You know, we're going to do three or four scenarios where, you know, the ball goes into feet. What's the best decision? You know, and we'll do it 10, 15 times, not until we get it right, until we start thinking more critically on our own with the ball at our feet. Because like I said, you know, those things that you have to go through, those kind of pillars of the moment, they go in a split second. In that split second, when you start thinking, mate, was that the right decision? Was there a reward? The ball might be back at your feet and you've got a whole new scenario. And every time you move, the field moves. You have to take new pitches. You have to scan over and over again. It goes full circle to Frank Lampard. I mean, when he's moving and scanning, who else is moving? The player's trying to pick him up. So if he recognizes that moment to come towards a player with the ball, someone's come with him, it opens up gaps behind him. So his critical thinking without the ball is still as important as that player who's got the ball. He's helping that player with the ball make a great decision just with his movement. Might be 10 yards, might be a 20-yard run. It's like a third man run that doesn't pay off. You still make that run because you want to open up, you want to move your opposition. Soccer's about moving the opposition as much as it is the ball. So,
I think something you said there was a really, really important thing to consider, and that is repetition. You know, like you said, you might do it 15 times, you might do it 20 times, but the repetition is really important because it builds task familiarity. You know, there's a reason we work on patterns and pattern play. It's because we want to know, when I've got the ball, I want you to do this, I want you to do this. So then when I play this, this is what happens around. If I play this, this is what happens around.
Yeah. And so many different scenarios.
Yeah. Just building that task familiarity and and repeating it over and over and over again builds confidence.
Yeah. You don't just do it once and then like, oh, we've hit it. Right. So let's quit it. We're great. We're good to go.
Absolutely.
15, 20 times.
Yeah. And you want you want to put players in situations where they're having to make decisions often, because that builds a level of automaticity. It's and
that's a really big word.
Players that I mean, I'll use driving for an example. You know, when you first start out driving, especially kind of in the UK where, you know, you use gears, which we don't really do in the US.
I wouldn't know, mate.
oh, right. You didn't drive in the UK?
No. Oh. London, India, Singapore. Is that, I only learned to drive when I moved to the US.
Okay. So, yeah, I had to take my test in a manual car. Ooh. And what you...
Empty theft system.
at the beginning, you're really conscious of making sure you push the clutch, making sure the gear slides in and slots in properly. And, you know, there's confusion about which way to pull and push. But within a few kind of weeks or a few lessons, you're not thinking so much about, especially the clutch. It's an automatic response to your stimulus. You do it automatically. That allows you to concentrate a bit more on your manual change of gear. And then a few more lessons, you're not even thinking about gear. Now you're relating that to your speed. So you've kind of, you're looking at your speed, your speedometer, and you're going first gear to get going. Once you reach around the kind of 15 miles an hour mark, bang, slide into second gear. And then you're looking to see when you get up to that kind of 20, nearly 30 miles an hour, bang, into third gear, you know? And you're doing these things without even realizing. Another one is, how many times have you been driving somewhere, stopped at a red light, pulled off, and you've got halfway home, but don't remember the journey? You know, it's constant repetition of the same thing over and over again, where your decision-making becomes automatic, you know?
I think when I work on certain, like what I call functional training sessions, where we are going to work on, we've received the ball out wide in the attacking third, you know, this is the environment of the game, and just serving the ball in from a different area to see how the players change their shape and their position. Let's serve a ball from the left. Let's serve a ball from here. And, you know, try and make it as game. We always do this. We always try to make everything as game related as possible. You know, when you see these new coaches and they're doing stuff like, you know, here's a pass and they'll shoot with no defenders. What's the point? It's, you know, it's not super game related. So, you know, trying to make sure these players have every single piece of knowledge before they go into the game is what we do at the practice field.
Absolutely.
You know, these kids come up and they're, are we going to scrimmage? I'm like, we'll certainly finish with a game because I want to put into practice what we've been putting into theory all night. Your decision making on and off the ball, on and off the ball. So, yeah.
Small-sided games are a great way of developing.
So many quick touches in short time.
Yeah. And you know, there are so many considerations. You want to look at, are you playing with an overload, which makes the game easier for an attacking team? Or are you playing equal numbers? Or even, are you underloading a team or overloading the defense, you know, depending on what you're working on, to force players to have to make quicker decisions because they're under more pressure? Is the size of the field small and compact, which means that you have to be clinical with everything, including your decision-making, your touches, everything? Or is the field bigger, which is then allowing players to understand space, how to move into space, how their movement affects opponents, etc., etc.? You know, have we developed first touches on both feet? Have we developed an ability to dribble with both feet and turn in directions with both feet?
So again, it comes to, you know, some players technically make better decisions because they're technically better players.
Yeah.
Technically, use both feet. You know, if you've got a player who's 90% left-footed and he receives the ball on his right, like if you just play it right now, 20 yards, and he can't, or she can't rather, because technically they're not up to it. They might be really smart tactically, but if you don't have both feet, it becomes a really sore point. You've got to play him to his left, otherwise, you know, he won't pass. Like Lamella uses his left elbow, but not his left leg.
Yeah, right.
And I think, you know, to wrap up this topic, I mean, at what age, and you've been coaching as long as I have, at what age do you start that kind of process of teaching young players out there these days? It's not too early to start thinking about tactics rather than just go out and win the game, Lily. You know, go out there, Lily, have a great time. But, you know, how many mistakes does Lily have to make every weekend before a coach says, look, decision making, let's talk about it?
I think tactical decision making is kind of dependent on the group that you have. So if you've got a group who are technically fabulous at 11, 12, you can start to teach them that side of the game at kind of like a U11, U12 age.
Yeah.
Generally, players don't really kind of have the maturity mentally to be able to understand a tactical game plan. And this is just based on, you know, the science that's out there at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, all of those things that I was mentioning earlier, you know, can you get tight? Can a player receive a turn both directions? You know, can you find spaces by dropping into areas? You know, playing backwards is another one. Yeah. These are all things that I think come from using multi-directional games. You know, when you play the ball into me, if I can turn on my left, I can attack the two goals to my left. But if I'm able to open up on my right, I can attack the two goals on my right as well. So being able to go in two directions using two different feet are, you know, is hugely beneficial. So I would encourage coaches to use a lot more multi-directional games. Yeah. And they don't have to be, I know people will say, yeah, but the game's not played in multi directions, it's played in one direction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a point to that, but use that in your end game. Yeah. You know, if you're looking to develop, you know, especially when you're looking to develop a tactical plan, then multi-directional games are what are going to get people receiving on back feet, scanning their shoulders, get them being able to go in two directions, being able to play backwards, you know, because in the multi-directional game, I'm not only attacking goals in front of me, I can attack goals behind me.
Yeah.
So it gets players open to playing backwards a bit more. And, you know, as you start to develop the understanding for the players of the tactics of the game, because they've been playing these multi-directional games from 8, 9 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, it becomes second nature. And so, that's decision making. How to improve decision making? I think using multi-directional games is a huge way of improving the mental maturity of the player in terms of their decision making, for sure.
So yesterday I spent the whole day working with my Portland ODP, which is Oregon Developmental Program, kids, and they are there. They're 2009, 2010, 2011, and 2012. We had our end of season tournament against the other RTCs and ODPs, which was great. Some of these kids were going for an ODP group pool, and some of the kids were just playing for fun. And it was just a fantastic day. It rained almost up, started raining at the last minute of the day, which was great. I'm watching 9-year-old kids practice their goal celebrations, kids making their first PK, kids taking free kicks for the first time, having loads of fun. And as I get up to around about the 2009s, which was my group, I've got two great assistants, Miguel and Sal. I was asked to play up a 2010 girl in my 2009s. Not the first time this has happened to me. You know, I think it's a topic that kind of needs looking at, not so much as addressing. So she's come in. She's got a very famous older sister. I've seen her play. She's been in a few of my training sessions before. Technically, she's pretty wonderful. She's one of these kids that, you know, will not make tourists in Paris for the rest of her life because she's just got great foot skills, really smart soccer brain. Put her in the 4-versus-4 warm-up game for 10 minutes. Every time she touched the ball, she got tackled by a much bigger girl. same age, but just much bigger. She gets frustrated, then she starts like pushing back, and you know, her technical skills just go out the window. So we come to the 9 versus 9 games, 35 minutes straight through, no breaks, roll in, roll on. Great game, great weekend. Everyone starts coming over to watch her just because they know what her surname is. Mm-hmm. Three or four of my the coaches, like the directors there, like, nope, she's a no, she's too small. She's out of shape, you know, physically. I mean, she was out of breath after a 10-yard run. And it comes to a certain point, like, who's making this decision? Is it the best decision for the kid? Okay, she's smaller than everyone else on the field by a huge distance. She's going to get injured much more. That's going to be bad for her esteem. Technically, you know, she doesn't read the game as fast as other kids do. Is that because they're a year more advanced than her? And then the last thing is, like, is it better for my team to have a younger player come out? What message does that send to my team that we're bringing in someone younger than you who might be better than you?
Yeah.
So I know. What do you think about those 3 points?
I think, yeah. I think you've valid concerns on all 3 points, to be honest. For me, I've always taken the stance that if at a tryout, a player that's playing up, if they're in your kind of top three, top five players for the group, then fine. You know, I'm okay with them playing up. I think there are definite benefits to playing up. You know, you're playing against people who are not only kind of chronologically older than you, but in terms of their training age, they might be older than you. In terms of their kind of development, the developmental age, they're going to be a little bit older than you as well. So there's tons to learn. There is usually when you get a player playing up, they're usually a bigger kid. And so the physical stuff doesn't hurt them. If you're a small kid and you're playing up, it's great for you in terms of, because I was always a small kid playing with bigger kids.
Same here.
And it's good for you in terms of learning how to kind of ride tackles, learning how to release quickly, learning how basically to play the game in such a way where that bigger person can't kick you, can't lean on you, can't push you off the ball, can't use the physicality. The problem with somebody so young is they're at an age where they should still be working on their technical development. And I don't think, again, you know, each player is different.
Yeah, but very different.
Forcing such a young kid to have to play one and two touch soccer or football because they've been put into an age group that, you know, at a time when it's maybe a little bit too early, all you're doing is you're taking away from their ability to receive the ball properly. You're taking away from their ability to have to scan. You're taking away, you know, all of the other learning points that need to...
Instead of actually adding to their skills, you're actually taking away their skills, in theory. You're not actually adding anything to them, except from experience. You're actually taking, like you just said, you're taking away a certain skill set. It could be all three of those.
An important skill set.
Especially at that age, because it's the ODP stands for Oregon Development. We're developing young soccer players. You know, and is playing it up? Is it? I mean, and who's making that decision? Is it the parents? Is it the directors? Is it the coach? You know,
isn't it funny though that in most, you know, I remember in the UK before coming out here, and the big criticism of English footballers was there isn't anybody that can actually just get the ball and run at anyone. There isn't anyone that can make things happen. And this is about around about the time where there's the emergence of Ronaldo and Messi.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, why don't we create players like that? Players that can just pick up the ball and run at people. And it's because when kids are 10, all we want to do is have them pass.
Yeah.
You know,
we encourage them to move the ball, to move the opposition.
If you're, and that's fine. But for me, teaching them to pass to move the opposition is a tactical thing.
Yeah.
So bring that in at 13.
Yeah.
You know, up until 13, let players have the ball
technical and
beat their player 1v1.
Yeah.
Let them run at, you know, run at two defenders.
Yeah.
Or, you know, see if they can create a 2v1 to see if they can kind of do a 1-2 or use the second person as a decoy to beat a defender 1v1.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it should be, we should focus a lot more on the kind of the smaller elements of the game, the 1v1s, the 2v2s, that kind of thing,
yeah,
as opposed to the kind of the bigger sort of grand scheme of the game.
Yeah. And I think, you know, after watching, and I've coached this young lady before, and she's talented and she is small. And I think she's more likely to be one for the future than right now. And I, you know, just watching some of my bigger, stronger 09 girls, just the way they approach it. It's like, okay, I'm just going to go in at 50%, put a tackle in, and you're going to fall down just because of pure physical strength. And, you know, she tried to work around that by being super skillful or being a bit cheeky, you know, using all the skills and trying to nutmeg every player. And in the end, you know, it wasn't embarrassing. It was just like, I've just seen some of my best players at their best, just dealing with someone who just has one vision in their mind. Let me show you 65 touches of the ball without me even moving. And my players just stood in front of her physically because they just dominated her, took the ball away from her, passed, and we scored goals. And her theory was hands on the hips, look around, oh, they've scored again because I can't pass the ball. And I think, you know, there are good reasons to play up. You know, if a child is developmentally, and I mean physically, ahead of his or her peers and tends to rely on their physical attributes more than their technique, then yeah, maybe. The second one would be, is a child technically and tactically so far ahead of their own age group, there's no challenge anymore. And then, you know, they quit. And then the third one would be when a child starts playing up, should they be eased into that situation, not just like literally thrown in? Like, hey, 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there. So what's your thought on one of those?
I mean, I would disagree with a big player who maybe isn't technically good enough playing up. I mean, what's the point? You know, you might be able to handle yourself physically.
Yeah.
You might be the biggest player on the field. But if technically you can't do anything with the ball, then...
Yeah.
How is that going to affect your confidence? You know, I think too often we look at players playing up from one point of view, and that's the physical point of view.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I think, and this is what I alluded to, what I was alluding to earlier was, I think when you're looking at a player that potentially is playing up, you have to look at all six pillars. And I don't do the whole four pillar thing. I do a six pillar sort of thing. So physically, are they, you know, able to compete? Technically, are they able to compete? Then you want to look at the tactical understanding of what's going on. At that very young age, that pillar doesn't really kind of come into things that much, but
that's,
you still want to have an
age specific. Yeah.
You still want to have an understanding of what's going on, what it is that you're trying to achieve. And then psychologically, Are you prepared, you know, for when you're pushed up and things aren't going your way?
Yeah.
Especially if you've got people around you that have been singing your praises about how great you are in terms of your ability and all of that sort of stuff.
Sure.
Then you go and you play against someone who basically just dominates you. And, you know, what does that say for your identity? So psychologically, how does that affect them? But then the extra two pillars that I like to use when I'm doing my kind of analysis are the emotional side of the game.
Yeah. How does it affect them?
What's your emotional control? Even a year's difference.
Yeah. Big difference.
A year's difference. You look at the age, you know, before puberty, after puberty, you look at before high school, after high school, that 1 year difference can make a huge, you know, difference. In terms of emotional kind of control, can make a huge difference. And I feel like that isn't really taken into that really isn't considered enough.
Yeah, you know? I mean, you're right. I mean, so like, you know, a 12-year-old girl, if she's a defender, she makes a mistake and her team concedes a goal or maybe loses the game. Yeah, she's going to be upset. And if there's 10 minutes left, she needs to bounce back to make a difference in the next 10 minutes. A girl or boy, an athlete slightly younger, mature and emotionally, might start crying. And I've seen it. I've seen boys and girls cry because they've made a mistake. So, you know, that kind of, you're right, one of those pillars should be, and it should be involved in a lot, is the kid emotionally strong enough to play at this level where defeats become part, you know, not hopefully part of the game, but it is part of the game. we might lose today against the state champions. Are you ready for that? I don't like losing. It upsets me. And, you know, you've also got to prepare the parents for that.
Yeah, right, for sure. You know, it is a huge responsibility on the parents. And unfortunately, I don't think they stand up to it enough. You know, but like, even just looking at the emotional side of things, you know, are you going to be the player that gives the ball away and then the team breaks on you and scores? And rather than break down, are you going to be emotionally angry and go and get yourself sent off? Are you going to be emotionally frustrated and take it out on your players and blame your players? You know, so.
And we've all seen that.
That's one thing to consider. I also think the sixth pillar is the social side of things. You know, if the players are older than you, and again, we can use the kind of sort of year before high school and in high school, you know, eighth and ninth grade in the US, you know, high school kids are talking high school kids stuff in practice. And now you've got a player who isn't at high school.
Can't be involved
in those conversations. Maturity level is lowered. So now they're trying to get involved in conversations. They've got no part, you know, no kind of place in being involved in. They've got no point of reference to be involved in those conversations. And so, you know, socially, you could alienate the player by putting him into a situation that they're not ready for. So I just think when you're looking at whether a player should play up, you've got to consider all of these factors. And if you can tick the box on all of those factors, then absolutely. And this is where I was saying, do they fit into the top five, top three or top five of your group? You know, if like my age group at the moment is two teams. So when I'm talking about, can you fit in? I'm not basically saying, how do you fit into the, you know, top five of that second team and you play, and then you can come up and play in a second team. No. If you're going to play up, you need to be one of the top five players in the whole age group. Out of the whole 50 players or whatever it is.
Yeah. You need to be top level, top tier.
If you're not, stay where you are.
Yeah.
You know?
And develop more. You know?
Yeah. There's nothing to say that you can't stay where you are and every so often come up and play.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you talked about the pillars, which I think is an important part. I mean, the point you just made. Okay, here's a younger girl. She's going to hang out with these high school age girls. Them high school girls are talking about something, but you don't want them to dumb down their conversations. Oh, can you just talk about teddy bears and candy because there's a younger girl coming? And at the same time, you don't teach that younger athlete, you need to start talking about this because that's what the other girls are talking about. It's unfair, it's unrealistic, and it shouldn't happen.
Yeah, you just see it. I've had quite a few teams that have gone from the, you know, through that high school sort of transition where you end up, your one team ends up being split into two because half of the girls are going to high school, half of them are not.
Yeah, been there before. Yeah.
And, you know, you get new players that come into the group and they are kind of standing on the sidelines by themselves with a ball, you know, because they don't really kind of know, especially if they're new to the group. They don't know who's at high school, who's not at high school, who they can go and talk to, you know, on a certain level.
Yeah.
And you know, it can be quite painful.
And so, that is one of the pillars. That is the social pillar, right? Are you in a position to be socially
Are you socially mature enough to handle be put into certain situations?
Yeah,
you
know? Absolutely. I think some of the worst reasons, and these are kind of funny. These are some of the ones that I've worked with, and you probably can relate to some of these. We can't break that kid up because she's in our carpool. Number one.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Her best friend is on that team, number two. That team is coached by her favorite or his favorite coach ever. He plays up in other sports. Older siblings have always played up. He's in the same grade as those kids on the team. Mm-hmm. Our team has been together for 3 years and the parents have a lot of money. Those are some of the best ones I've heard, mate.
I mean,
you can put them in any order. You know, the carpool one is funny. Well, you've broken up our carpool, coach. I'm like, that's your job, not mine.
I actually remember doing a tryout when I was living in Utah. And there was one kid who probably got between 5 and 10 minutes a game. And was one of the weaker players in the age group, but he was, you know, the thing about Utah's the, you know, the community, the strength in community is like anything I've ever seen, you know. A lot of, you know, stuff gets said about the religious kind of...
Are you Mormon?
Of those... I'm not. No.
Just asking.
the religious element of those in Utah. But I can tell you firsthand...
There's together. I've been there a few times.
There's some of the best people in the world. Like, yeah. When I lived there for a year, and I was made to feel 100% welcome all the time. I never had any problems with anyone there. And so there was this one kid who's part of this team and probably shouldn't be, he should be playing on the team below, where he's probably going to be one of the strongest players, getting a little bit more time where he can then develop to then push for that, you know, that team again the following season. Okay. And I'm trying to explain this to the coach. And I've just basically, I'm an independent contractor while I did coach at the club.
Yeah.
The club basically said, look, you're an independent eye. We trust you to basically make fair decisions. So you run a tryout. So I ran tryouts for, you know, 10 or 12 teams, maybe even 14 teams in the age group. In the club. And I'm trying to explain the developmental side of things.
Yes.
And they're basically, oh no, but you know, he's a great kid, and you know, we really love his parents, and I'm saying, yeah, all that's well and good, but that's not going to help the player improve. Yeah. And that's what you're in this for.
Yeah.
You know, you're in this for developing the player.
Yeah.
And they come back with the argument of, yeah, but we also want to make sure we're developing the person. Absolutely. 100%.
And I think, you know, the key word that we've both used a few times, both of us, is develop. We are developing character. We're developing this. Yeah, it's develop.
That's what it's all about, you know? And I can understand that as an argument, except how much are you developing a person's character if they're only getting a few minutes on the field? It's not fair on the player, you know? And they basically said, well, you know, he doesn't moan about it. He's, you know, he takes it. No. He's okay with it. I'm just like...
He's okay with it.
Yeah. At that point, I've got nothing else. I can't go anywhere else, you know.
Yeah.
Well, all right.
This is
my recommendation.
Yeah.
This is my recommendation. Yeah. You know, I don't know how it panned out, because then I left to come to Oregon. But you know, we have to make sure when we are working with players, especially players. I mean, I've got a player in my club at the moment who is playing 2 years up, and you know, while there's, you know, physically, when you're looking at ticking the boxes, while physically she's absolutely got it, technically superb.
Yeah,
probably one of the best. Yeah,
yeah,
one of the best in the age.
Absolutely, team,
in the state. Yeah. You know,
well, good, because she's my goalkeeper. Remember?
Yeah, right. She should be going on to play at college quite comfortably, I imagine.
She's a great kid.
As long as she keeps her level of work rate up, because she's a very hard worker.
She is. She's a great kid.
She is a fantastic kid.
Yeah.
But what she's going through at times is this, you know, I can't really associate so much with the high school girls.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I'm not a high school yet.
It's a roller coaster, you know, of emotions without the sucker, you know.
And it can lead to isolation. It can lead to her being isolated a little bit. And, you know, that's one of those things that we as coaches have to try to navigate, you know. And it's something I've spoken to my team about, making sure that they're kind of looking after her and talking to her and making her feel welcome.
Yeah.
But she's never going to feel as comfortable socially than she is when she's with people of her own age.
Her own peers. Because, peers,
you know, they can talk on
the same level.
And, you know, and so.
And as coaches, we need to be really aware of, like, you know, when we do bring in players to play up, you know, we have to be the coach, the psych, the brother, the uncle, whatever, you know. We have to be so many things, different hats. And I think playing up is okay, but it has to be a certain situation, a certain player. And it has to be managed every time you're with them.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So, I mean, yeah, in your situation, having a famous sister probably doesn't help.
No pressure.
Because, yeah, and you know, we don't have this ability to separate you know, players based on their individual.
Yeah.
You know, you see one kid who's a phenom.
Yeah.
And then you look at the sibling who is also very high level, mm-hmm. but isn't quite the phenom.
Yeah.
But we have this expectation that we should just be able to chuck them in there because, you know, they're from the same stock.
Yeah. And again, and the word there is expectation, right? A parent's expectation,
right?
Club expectation, director's expectations.
And this is the thing, you know, that stuff needs to be managed. And, you know, it means having hard conversations, but you know, that's what we're here for. Yeah. You have to have these difficult conversations. Yeah. You know, you're not quite ready. It will tell you a lot about a player and about the family unit. If you say to somebody, I don't think you're quite ready, and you lay out your rationale, and there's a poor emotional reaction to that.
Yeah.
You kind of know what you're going to get from the player.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you know, just as a last word, this is why college recruitment looks at family units so much.
They do, yeah.
You know, if the family isn't going to be able to kind of manage their expectations, then when things go wrong, how are we expecting the player to manage expectations?
And maybe we can hit on that subject in next week's podcast about going from high school to college and the difference in. And ability, agility, and everything else.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed listening and you've taken a little bit out of it. If you'd like to get in touch, if you'd like to leave any comments for us, or you know, if you've got anything that you'd like us to talk about, please feel free to get in touch. You can get in touch with us on our social media. That is on Instagram, I am A9 Soccer, Wayne is Elevate Soccer, and then we have the Coach's Coach podcast. And if you want to get in touch on Twitter, you can get in touch with Coach's Coach Pod. Look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week.